If I cooperate with the propagandist, I can have more time. If I tell the bleak truth, then no. And they'll probably make the American broadcaster disappear too, and I'll have that on my conscience. The aspirin and kerosene are part of Operation Cinderella, a program designed to transform me from a feverish, knit-infested, mentally unstable prison rat back into a detained flight officer of cool nerve and confidence suitable for presentation to a radio interviewer. To add credibility to our story, I've been given a sort of translation job, copying Hauptsturmfuhrer von Linden's own notes from the past year here, with names when he knows them, and dates and, ugh, some methods used, in addition to information extracted. Oh, mein Hauptsturmfuhrer, you are an evil Jerry bastard. A copy is to be made in German for his CO. He has a commanding officer. And another made in French for some other official purpose. I am doing the French one. Fräulein Engel is doing the German. She is back today. We are working together and using up all my ill-gotten recipe cards. We are both cross about that. The job is both horrific and unbelievably tedious. And so deviously instructional it makes me want to put the man's eyes out with my pencil. I am made to see into a small methodical corner of von Linden's mind. Not anything personal, but how he works. And also that he is good at it. Unless, of course, it is all fabricated to intimidate me. I don't actually think he is imaginative enough to do that. At least not in the way I use my imagination. Not to pretend anything. Not to concoct a fake collection of half a dozen notebooks bound in calfskin and filled with tragic miniature portraits of 150 doomed spies and resistance fighters. But he is creative in his own scientific way. A technician, an engineer, an analyst. I'd love to know what his civilian credentials are. His persuasive techniques are tailored to the individual as he gains understanding into the character of each. Those 3 weeks I spent starving in the dark, waiting for something to happen. He must have been watching me like a hawk, tallying my silences, my tantrums, my numerous half-successful attempts to clamber out of the transom window, the heating duct, the air vent, to pick the lock, garrot and or emasculate various guards, etc. Observing how I cower and weep and plead whenever the screaming starts in the next room. Observing how I frantically try to put my hair up whenever someone opens the door and sees me. Not everyone is questioned in their dreadful undergarments. It is a special torment reserved for the modest and the vain. I am one of the latter. It is comforting to discover that I am not, after all, the only Judas to have been interned behind these desecrated hotel walls. I suppose von Linden would be sacked if his success rate were that dismal. And now I suspect as well that I am exposed to the stubborn ones on purpose to demoralize me, perhaps with the dual effect of humiliating them at their most vulnerable moments with an embarrassing and appreciative audience. I am still quite presentable. They have always gone easy on my hands and face, so when I'm fully dressed you'd never look at me and think I'd recently been skewered and barbecued. They've packed their partially dismantled wireless set into a smooth and pleasing case. Perhaps it has been VL's intention all along to use me in his little propaganda exercise. And of course, I am willing to play. How did he know? How did he know from the start, even before I told him? That I am always willing to play, addicted to the great game. Oh, mein Hauptsturmfuhrer, you evil Jerry bastard. I am grateful for the eiderdown they have given me to replace the verminous blanket. Even if it is just part of the temporary scheme to rehabilitate me, it is bliss. Half the stuffing has come out and it smells like a root cellar full of damp, but still, an eiderdown. A silk eiderdown. It is embroidered CDB. So it must be spoiling stock from this building's former life as the Chateau de Bordeaux. I do sometimes wonder what happened to the hotel's furnishings. Someone must have gone to a good deal of effort to empty all the guest rooms of their wardrobes and beds and vanity tables, and to bolt bars across the window shutters. What did they do with everything? Carpets, curtains, lamps, light bulbs. Certainly my little room has no Gallic charm to recommend it, apart from its rather pretty parquet floor, which I can't see most of the time. As with all the prisoners' rooms, my window has been boarded shut, and which is very cold and hard to sleep on. I'd better get to work. Though I have bought my extra week, I now have only half as much time each day for writing, and my day is longer too. I'm getting tired. I know. Special Ops Exec. Right. Ferry Pilot. Maddie went back to Oakway. There was now an air transport auxiliary ferry pool there, and Oakway had also become the biggest parachute training centre in Britain. As an ATA pilot, Maddie was demoted in rank and a civilian again. But she was able to live at home, and she was given a petrol allowance for her bike so she could get to the airfield, and she could trade in a day's completed ferry chit for a 2-ounce bar of Cadbury's milk chocolate. Maddie was in her element at last. No matter that the sky had changed, it was an obstacle course of balloon cables and restrictions and military aircraft and, often, dirty weather. Maddie was in her element, and her element was air. They throw you through some aerobatics that you'll never use. Watch you take off and land something, and hey presto, you're qualified to fly Class 3 aircraft, light twin engines, and all the Class 2s, heavy single engines, without ever having seen most of them. Maddie said they are supposed to do 30 long-distance training flights up and down the country to imprint it on their brains until they can fly without looking at a map. But she got signed off at 12 because it was taking too long to wait for decent weather, and they wanted her working. There is an ATA pilot killed every week. They are not shot down by enemy fire. They fly without radio or navigation aids into weather that the bombers and fighters call unflyable. So Maddie, first day on the job, walks into the hut that the Oakway ATA pilots laughingly call their mess hall. "There's a Lysander chalked up here with your name on it," says her new operations officer, pointing to the blackboard with its list of aircraft to be moved.
"Has it really?"
Everyone laughs at her, but not meanly.
"Never flown one, have you?" says the Dutchman, a former KLM pilot who knows the north of England almost as well as Maddie does, having made regular passenger landings at Oakway from the time it opened.
"Well," says Ops, "Tom and Dick are taking the Whitleys over to Newcastle, and Harry is taking the Hurricane. That leaves the taxi Anson and the Lysander for the ladies, and Jane's got the Anson."
"Where's the Lysander going?"
"Elmtree, for repair. Faulty tailplane hand wheel. It's flyable, but you have to hold the control column right forward."
"I'll do it," says Maddie.
Not a safe job.
They gave her a very thorough navigation briefing beforehand, as the aircraft's defect meant she couldn't expect to fly hands-free. She wouldn't be able to juggle maps en route. She sat studying the pilot's notes for an hour, the detailed notes they give the operational pilots who only ever fly one type of aircraft. Then panicked about losing the weather. Now or never. The ground crew was aghast at the idea of a girl flying the broken Lysander.
"She won't be strong enough. With the tail set for takeoff, yon slip of a lass won't be able to hold the stick hard forward enough for landing. Don't know if anyone could."
"Someone landed it here," Maddie pointed out. She'd already been given the chit for the job, and wanted to leave while she could still see the Pennines. "Look, I'll just set it neutral by hand before I get in. Easy peasy." And she gently pushed the tail into place, stood back and dusted her hands on her slacks. Navy, with an Air Force blue shirt and navy tunic and cap. The mechanics were still frowning, but they'd stopped shaking their heads. "It'll be a pig to fly," Maddie said. "I'll just keep the climb out and landing nice and long and shallow. Come in fast, 85 knots, and the automatic flaps will stay up. It's not too windy, should be fine." At last, one of the lads gave a slow, reluctant nod.
"Thou'll manage, lass," he said. "I can see thou'll manage."
That first ATA flight Maddie made was hard work. Not frightening, just hard work.
It was hard at first to look past the gun sight sockets and camera fixing plates and rows of bomb selector switches for bombs she wasn't carrying, a Morsing key for a radio that wasn't connected, etc.
Fly the plane, Maddie.
The six familiar, friendly faces of the flight instrument panel smiled at her behind the control column. One of the ground crew anxiously made sure she knew where to find the forced landing flare release. The weather cooperated for her, but the Lysander fought her for nearly 2 hours. When she tried to land at Elmtree, she misjudged the amount of runway she was going to need. Hands and wrists aching with the effort of keeping the control column far enough forward to land, Maddie took off again without touching down and had to come in over the runway twice more before she got it right. But she landed safely at last.
I sound so authoritative. It must be the immediate effect of the aspirin. Imagine if you gave me Benzedrine.
And I still crave coffee. Maddie, also craving coffee, went to scrounge a sandwich from the workshop canteen and found another ferry pilot there ahead of her. Tall, square-faced, with dark brown hair shorter than Maddie's, in uniform navy slacks and tunic with the double gold shoulder stripes of a first officer. For a moment, Maddie was confused, thinking that, like Queenie, she was seeing ghosts.
Lions! Maddie exclaimed.
The pilot looked up, frowned, and answered tentatively,
Brought it?
Then Maddie saw it wasn't the vicar's son who used to fly at Maid's End before being shot down and incinerated in flaming petrol over the South Downs last September, but someone who clearly must be his twin sister. Or an ordinary sister, anyway. They stared at each other in bewilderment for a moment. They had never met. The other girl beat her to the question.
But how do you know my name? You look exactly like your brother. I was a waff at Maid's End with him. We used to talk about maps. He wouldn't ever dance.
That was Kim, said the girl, smiling. I liked him. I'm sorry.
My name's Theo, she offered Maddie her hand. I'm in the women's ferry pool at Stratfield.
How do you know my name? Maddie asked.
It's chalked up on the assignment board in the radio room, First Officer Lyons said. We're the only ATA pilots here today. They usually send girls in the Lysanders. The lads all want something faster. Have a sandwich, you look like you could use one.
I've never flown a Lysander before, said Maddie, and I wish I never would again. This one just about killed me.
Oh, you brought in the faulty tailplane. It's terribly unfair of them to give you a broken Lizzie on your first go. You must have another go immediately, flying one that works.
Maddie took the offered half-sandwich, bully beef straight from the tin as usual.
Well, I have to, I suppose, she said. I've got to take one from here down to its normal base this afternoon. It's not top priority, but it's got one of those S-chits. Secrecy and a report required. It's my first day on the job, too.
You lucky thing! That's RAF Special Duties.
RAF Special Duties?
Your guess is as good as mine. They're sort of embedded in the normal RAF base that you fly into, but after you've landed there 2 or 3 times, you start to work it out. A little fleet of Lysanders camouflaged in black and dark green, all equipped with long-range fuel tanks, and the runway laid out with electric lamps. Night landings in short fields. She let that hang between them. France, Belgium, resistance agents, refugees, wireless equipment and explosives smuggled into Nazi-occupied Europe. You didn't dare talk about it. You just didn't. It's brilliant fun landing a Lizzie in their training field. They have a mock flare path laid out, little yellow flags. You can play you're a special duties pilot. Lysander's a wizard at short landings. You could land one in your granny's garden.
Maddie could scarcely believe that, having just managed to get her first Lizzie down only by using every available inch of runway.
Theo pulled her crust to pieces and arranged 3 crumbs in an inverted L-shape to imitate torches blazing in a dark French meadow. Here's what you do. She glanced quickly over each shoulder to make sure she wasn't overheard. They're always a bit boggled when a girl leaps out of the cockpit afterwards. They were a bit boggled when I got in this morning.
How's your navigation? You're not allowed to mark this airfield on your map.
takes a bit of studying before you leave so you can find it yourself.
I can manage that, Maddie said confidently, and truthfully, having earlier that day done almost exactly the same thing.
It'll be fun, Theo repeated enthusiastically, encouraging her. You couldn't get better training if they gave you a course. Flying a broken plane for 2 hours, then landing a fixed one in 20 yards in the same day, we might as well be operational.
All right, this airfield, the special duties airfield. It is the same one Maddie and I took off from 6 weeks ago. The pilots who use it are called the Moon Squadron. They fly by moonlight and only by moonlight. The location of their airfield is one of our most closely guarded secrets, and I thank God I don't know its name or have any clue where it is. I really don't, though I have been there at least 5 times. I was always flown there from my own base outside Oxford, in the dark, sometimes via another aerodrome, and I don't even know which direction we set off in to get there. They did that on purpose. Their planes need a lot of maintenance as they tend to go through them quite rapidly, bashing the undercarriages in the dark and getting bits blown off by anti-aircraft guns on their way home. Later, Maddie made that run several times, ferrying damaged or mended aircraft in and out of the bigger aerodrome that surrounds them and hides them. More recently, she served them as a taxi pilot, delivering their rather special passengers. The dozen or so quite suicidally deranged pilots who were stationed there grew familiar with Maddie's increasingly expert, dead-stop-accurate short-field landings. And by and by, they knew when she'd arrived before she'd got out of the plane.
I'm out of time again. Hell! I was enjoying myself.
Orme, 1811-43, JBS. Engel thinks I am translating von Linden's horrid notes, but I'm sneaking in a few recipe cards of my own because I've got ahead of her. She can be a perfect fount of information when she's in the mood. It is because of her nattering on at me while I was hard at work that she has fallen behind. She tells me that if I am lucky, I will be sent to a place called Ravensbrück when they have finished with me here. It is a concentration camp solely for women, a labor camp and prison. Perhaps it is where the charwoman who stole the cabbages was sent. Basically, it is a death sentence. They more or less starve you until you can't work, and then when you become too weak to shift any more rubble for replacing the roads blown up by our Allied bombers, they hang you. I am ideally suited to shifting rubble, having previous experience on the runway at Maidsend. If you are not put to work breaking rocks, you get to incinerate the bodies of your companions after they have been hanged. If I am not lucky, in other words, if I do not produce a satisfactory report in the time allotted, I will be sent to a place called Natzweilerstrutthof. This is a smaller and more specialized concentration camp, the vanishing point for Nacht- und Nebel prisoners, who are mostly men. Occasionally, women are sent there as live specimens for medical experiments. I am not a man, but I am designated Nacht- und Nebel. God. If I am very lucky, I mean if I am clever about it, I will get myself shot. Here, soon. Engel didn't tell me this, I thought it out myself. I have given up hoping the RAF will blow this place to smithereens. I want to update my list of 10 things I am afraid of. 1. Cold. I've replaced my fear of the dark with Maddie's fear of being cold. I don't mind dark now, especially if it's quiet. It gets boring sometimes. 2. Falling asleep while I'm working. 3. Bombs dropping on my favorite brother. 4. Kerosene. Just the word on its own is enough to reduce me to jelly, which everybody knows and makes use of to great effect. 5. SS Hauptsturmführer Amadeus von Linden. Actually, he should be at the top of this list. The man blinds me with fear, but I was taking the list in its original order and he has replaced the college porter. 6. Losing my pullover. I suppose that counts under cold, but it is something I worry about separately. 7. Being sent to Natzweilerstrutthof.
8. Being sent back to England and having to file a report on what I did in France. 9. Not being able to finish my story. 10. Also of finishing it. I am no longer afraid of getting old. Indeed, I can't believe I ever said anything so stupid, so childish, so offensive and arrogant. But mainly, so very, very stupid. I desperately want to grow old. Everybody is getting excited about the American radio woman's visit. My interview will be held in von Linden's study, office, whatever it is. I was taken to see it earlier today, so that I would be forewarned and not fall over in a dead faint of astonishment seeing it for the first time in front of the interviewer. Pretend all my interviews take place beneath the Venetian glass chandelier in this cozy wood-paneled den. Pretend I sit writing at his pretty little 18th-century marquetry table every afternoon. Pretend I ask his pet cockatoo in its bamboo cage to supply me with unfamiliar German words when I get stuck. Or perhaps not. The helpful cockatoo might seem a little too far-fetched. I am not writing there now. I am in my usual bare broom cupboard, pulled up to the tubular steel table with my ankles tied to my chair, with SS Scharfuhrer Thibaut and his mate, whose name I haven't been told, breathing down my neck. I'm going to write about Scotland. I wasn't ever there with Maddie, but I feel as though I was. I don't know what she was flying the night she got stuck at Deeside near Aberdeen. It wasn't just Lysanders that she ferried, and she didn't do much taxi work that first year, so it probably wasn't an Anson. Let's say it was a Spitfire, just for fun. The most glamorous and beloved of fighter planes. Even the Luftwaffe pilots would let you pull out their back teeth with a pair of pliers if it would buy them an hour in control of a Spitfire. Let's say that late in November of 41, Maddie was delivering a Spitfire to this Scottish airfield where they'd fly out to defend the North Sea shipping, or perhaps to take pictures of Luftwaffe-occupied airfields in Norway. Our reconnaissance planes are tarted up in a lovely salmony mauve camouflage to match the clouds. So let's say Maddie was flying a pink Spitfire, but not up to the soaring blue heavens like the fighter pilots. She was flying cautiously, making her way along the coast and up the straths, the wide valleys of Scotland, because the cloud was low. She was 3,000 feet above sea level, but between the Tay and the Dee, the Cairngorm Mountains rise higher than that. Maddie flew alone, careful and happy, low over the snow-tipped highlands on those pretty tapered wings, deafened by the Merlin engine, navigating by dead reckoning. The glens were full of frost and fog. Fog lay in pillows in the folds of the hills. The distant mountaintops shone dazzling pink and white beneath rays of low sunshine that didn't touch the Spitfire's wings. The Haar, the North Sea coastal fog, was closing in. It was so cold that the moist air crystallized inside the plexiglass hood, so that it seemed to be lightly snowing in the cockpit. Maddie landed at Deeside just before sunset. But it wasn't sunset. It was twilight grey and turning blue, and she would either have to spend the night in a cheerless, unmade spare bed in the guest room of the officer's billet, or she'd have to find a guest house in Aberdeen. Or she'd have to spend half the night on an unheated and blacked-out train and perhaps arrive back in Manchester at 2 o'clock in the morning. Unwilling to face the loneliness of the airfield's Spartan accommodation, or a dour, granite-faced Aberdeen landlady who wouldn't accept her ration coupons for an unarranged evening meal, Maddie opted for the train. She walked to the branch line station at Deeside. There were no route maps posted on the walls, but a Wonderland-style sign commanding, "If you know where you are, then please tell others." There were no lights in the waiting room because they'd show when you opened the door. The ticket seller had a dim banker's lamp burning behind his wee cage. Maddie straightened herself out a bit. The girls in the ATA had been given a good splash of publicity in the papers and were expected to live up to certain standards of neatness. but she'd found that people didn't always recognize her navy uniform with its gold ATA pilot's wings, or make sense of them, and Scotland was as foreign a land as France to Maddie.
"Is there a train any time soon?" she asked.
"Aye, there is,"
agreed the ticket seller, as cryptic as the platform posters.
"When?"
10 minutes.
"Aye, 10 minutes.
Going to Aberdeen?"
"Och no, not to Aberdeen. The next train's the branch line to Castle Craig."
To make this easier, I am translating the ticket seller's speech from Aberdeen Doric. Maddie, not being fluent in the Doric herself, wasn't sure she'd heard correctly.
"Craig Castle?"
"Castle Craig," this bogle of a railway employee repeated laconically. "Single to Castle Craig, miss."
"No, no,"
Maddie said sensibly, and then in a fit of pure insanity brought on, no doubt, by loneliness and hunger and fatigue, added,
"Not a single. I've got to come back. A return, please. Third-class return to Castle Craig."
Half an hour later.
"Oh, what have I done?"
Maddie thought to herself, as the antique and ice-cold two-coach stopping train lurched and crept past a number of pitch-dark, anonymous station platforms, bearing Maddie further and further into the haunted foothills of the Scottish Highlands. The compartment in the railway carriage was dimly lit by one blue light overhead. The carriage was not heated. There were no other passengers in Maddie's compartment.
"When's the next train back?" she asked the ticket collector.
"Last one in 2 hours."
"Is there one before that?"
"Last one in 2 hours," he repeated unhelpfully.
Some of us still have not forgiven the English for the Battle of Culloden, the last battle to be fought on British soil, in 1746. Imagine what we will say about Adolf Hitler in 200 years. Maddie got off the train at Castle Craig. She had no luggage but her gas mask and her flight bag, containing a skirt which she was supposed to wear when she wasn't flying, but which she hadn't been able to change into, and her maps and pilot's notes and a circular slide rule for wind speed computations, and a toothbrush and her last flight's 2 ounce bar of chocolate. She remembered how she'd nearly wept with envy at Dimpna's description of having to spend the night in the back of a fox moth and nearly freezing to death. Maddie wondered if she'd freeze to death before the train she just got off finally went back to Deeside 2 hours later. Here, I think I should remind you that my family is long established in rather the upper echelons of the British aristocracy. Maddie, you will recall, is the granddaughter of an immigrant tradesman. She and I would not ever have met in peacetime. Not ever. Unless perhaps I decided to buy a motorbike in Stockport. Perhaps Maddie might have served me. But if she hadn't been such a cracking radio operator and been promoted so quickly, it's not likely we'd have become friends even in wartime, because British officers don't mingle with the lower ranks. I don't believe it for a minute that we wouldn't have become friends somehow, that an unexploded bomb wouldn't have gone off and blown us both into the same crater, or that God himself wouldn't have come along and knocked our heads together in a flash of green sunlight. But it wouldn't have been likely. At any rate, Maddie's growing misgivings on this particular ill-conceived rail journey were mostly based on her certainty that she simply could not go and knock on the door of a laird's castle and ask for accommodation, or even a cup of tea, while she waited for the return train. She was only Maddie Broadit and not a descendant of Mary Queen of Scots or Macbeth. But she had not taken the war into account. I have heard a good many people say that it is levelling the British class system. Levelling is perhaps too strong a word, but it is certainly mixing us up a bit. Maddie was the only passenger to get off at Castle Craig, and after she dithered on the platform for 5 minutes, the stationmaster came out to greet her personally.
"You are meet a young Jamie up the big house, are you?"
For a moment, Maddie was too surprised to answer.
"He'll be glad of sensible company, he will, alone in that castle with them young rascals from Glasgow."
"Alone?" Maddie croaked.
"Aye, the lady's away to Aberdeen for 3 days with the Women's Voluntary Service, packing socks and cigarettes to send to our lads fighting in the desert. It's young Jamie alone with them evacuees. 8 of them the lady took in, last ones in the queue. No one else would have them, the mucky wee lads with their nits and streaming noses. Dad's all at work on the ships, bombs dropping night and day. Kiddies never been out of the tenements in their lives. The lady said she'd raised 6 weans of her own, and 5 of them lads. 8 of someone else's lads wouldn't be much different. But she's gone and left young Jamie to make their tea with them poor mangled hands of his. Maddie's heart soared at the idea of helping Jamie make tea for 8 Glaswegian evacuees.
Can I walk there?
Aye, 1/2 mile along the main road to the gate, then 1 mile down the drive. Maddie thanked him, and he raised his cap to her.
How'd you know me for a friend of Jamie's?
She asked. Your boots, the station master said. All you RAF lads wear the same boots. Never seen young Jamie take his off. Wish I had a pair. Maddie walked through the windy dark to Craig Castle, bubbling over with giddy laughter and relief and anticipation.
I'm an RAF lad, she thought, and laughed aloud in the dark.
Craig Castle is a small castle. I mean, compared to Edinburgh or Stirling castles, or Balmoral where the king lives in the summer, or Glam's where the queen's family lives. But it is a proper castle, bits of it nearly 600 years old, with its own well in case of siege, and cellars you can use as dungeons or wine stores, and 4 different endless spiral stairways so that not all of the rooms on every level actually connect. There's a room lost behind a sealed wall. There's also a window missing on the wall outside and an extra chimney, so we know the room used to be there. Also, there are gun rooms and a billiard room and a smoking room, 2 libraries, innumerable retiring and drawing rooms, etc. At the moment, most of these are under dust sheets because everyone is off doing war work, including the staff. When Maddie arrived, it looked deserted. Blackout, of course. But she staunchly rattled the iron ratchet at the main door and eventually, a very grubby Glaswegian evacuee, with eggs smeared from the left corner of his mouth right across to his left ear, opened the door. He was carrying a candle in a tin candlestick.
Jack be nimble, Maddie said.
My name's Jock, retorted the evacuee.
Have I interrupted your tea?
Jock responded in a garble of excited Glaswegian syllables. He might as well have spoken German for all Maddie understood. He wanted to touch her gold wings. He had to point to them to get her to understand. She let him.
Come along through,
he said firmly, beaming as though she'd passed a test. He shut the massive oak and iron door behind them, and Maddie followed him into the labyrinth where I was born. They emerged in the below-stairs kitchen, with 4 sinks and 3 ovens and burners enough to cater meals for 50 guests, and a deal table big enough to seat all the staff if there were any. Around this table were 7 young lads. Properly young, primary school age, Jock being the eldest at about 12, all wearing hobnailed boots and short trousers to save on cloth, and patched over school pullovers in varying states of grottiness, all their faces smeared with egg, all-consuming toast soldiers at an alarming rate. Standing at the great black Victorian stovetop, presiding over a bubbling iron cauldron, was the honourable youngest son of the Laird of Craig Castle, looking every inch the modern Highland hero in a faded kilt of hunting Stuart tartan, hand-knitted woolen kilt hose, and a machine-knitted woolen RAF airman's sweater. His boots exactly matched Maddie's.
3 minutes, who's up? He announced, upending an extraordinary ormolu gilt hourglass and displaying a boiled egg with a pair of silver sugar tongs.
His maimed hands, 2 fingers and thumb remaining on each, were deft and quick. He sniffed the air.
Oi, Tam! You flip that toast before it burns! He barked,
then turned and saw Maddie. She wouldn't have recognized him as Jamie. Tonight he was the picture of rosy health, nothing like the grey-faced, grieving invalid she'd last seen slumping bandaged and unresponsive in a bath chair. But she'd never have doubted he was her best friend's brother. Same sleek fair hair, same small, light build, same quick, bewitching features with a faint hint of lunacy behind the bright eyes. He saluted her. The effect was incredible. All 7 young lads and Jock joined him smartly, leaping to their feet and scraping back chairs.
Second Officer Broadett of the Air Transport Auxiliary, he introduced her. The boys reeled off their names like a row of cadets.
Hamish, Angus, Mungo, Rabby, Tam, Wally, Ross and Jock.
The Craig Castle Irregulars, Jamie said. Would you like to join us in a boiled egg, Second Officer Broadit?
Maddie's egg allocation amounted to one per week. She usually donated it to her gran for baking, or for the Sunday morning fry-up, and she often had to miss that anyway.
There's hens all over the grounds, Hamish told her as she sat down with the boys. We get to eat every egg we find.
Keeps them busy too, looking for them, said Jamie.
Maddie took the top of her egg off with her spoon. The hot, bright yolk was like summer sun breaking through cloud. The first daffodil in the snow. A gold sovereign wrapped in a white silk handkerchief. She dipped her spoon in it and licked it. You lads, she said slowly, looking around at the grubby faces, have been evacuated to a magic castle.
It's true, miss,
said Jock, forgetting she was an officer. He gabbled at her in Glaswegian.
Speak slowly, Jamie commanded. Jock spoke loudly instead.
Maddie got the gist of it.
There's a ghost that sits at the top of the tower stairs. You go all cold if you walk through him by accident.
I've seen him, said Angus proudly.
Oh, you havenae, mocked Willie with deep scorn. And you sleep with a teddy, eh? There's nae ghosty.
They broke into an incomprehensible argument about the ghost. Jamie sat down across from Maddie and they beamed at each other.
I feel dead outnumbered, Maddie said.
Me too, Jamie agreed. He was more or less living in the kitchen in the smaller of the two libraries. The Craig Castle Irregulars mostly lived outside. They slept three to a bed in our ancestral four-posters. The laddies were happy to crowd in together as that's what they were used to at home, and it saved on sheets, leaving Ross and Jock to share on their own, Ross being Jock's wee brother. Jamie had them all wash up and brush their teeth military style, or school style, at the four kitchen sinks, two boys per sink, very efficient. Then he literally marched them all up to bed, installed Maddie in his fox's den of a library on the way, and came back to her 20 minutes later carrying a steaming silver coffee pot. It's real coffee, he said, from Jamaica. Mother hoards it for special occasions, but it's starting to lose its flavour now. He sank into one of the cracked leather armchairs in front of the fire grate with a sigh. How did you ever get here, Maddie Broadit?
Second to the right and then straight on till morning, she answered promptly. It did feel like Neverland.
Crikey. Why so obviously Peter Pan?
Maddie laughed. The Lost Boys gave it away.
Jamie studied his hands. Mother keeps the windows open in all our bedrooms while we're gone, like Mrs. Darling, just in case we come flying home when she's not expecting us. He poured Maddie a cup of coffee. My window's closed just now. I'm not flying at the minute.
He spoke without bitterness.
Maddie asked a question she'd wanted to ask him when she first met him, only she hadn't had the courage.
How did you ever manage to save your hands?
Pop my fingers in my mouth, Jamie answered readily. I swapped hands over every 30 seconds or so. Couldn't fit any more than 3 fingers at a time and thought I'd better concentrate on the ones I'd miss the most. My big brothers and little sister have all started to call me the Pobble Who Has No Toes, which is a very silly poem by Edward Lear.
He sipped his own coffee.
Having something to concentrate on probably saved more than just my hands. My navigator, who came down with me, just gave up. Only about an hour after we'd been in the water. Just let go. Didn't want to think about it.
You're going back?
He hesitated a little. But when he spoke, it was with determination, as though he had a puzzle to solve. My doctor says they might not want me in a bomber crew.
You've got a chap with one arm flying in the ATA, don't you? I thought they might take me. Ancient and tattered airmen, isn't that what they call you?
Not me, Maddie said. I'm one of the always terrified airwomen.
Jamie laughed.
You terrified? My eye.
I don't like guns, Maddie said. Someday I'll be fired on in the air, and I'll go down in flames just because I'm too blooming scared to fly the plane.
Jamie didn't laugh.
Must be awful, Maddie said quietly.
Have you flown at all? Since?
He shook his head.
I can, though.
From what she'd seen of him that night, she thought he probably could. How many hours have you got?
Hundreds, he said. Over half of them at night. Mostly on Blenheims. That's what I was flying all the time I was operational.
What did you train on? Maddie asked.
Anson's. Lysander's at first.
He was watching her intently over his coffee, as though she were conducting an interview and he were waiting to hear if he'd got the job. Of course it was none of her business and she had no authority. But she'd landed Lysander's herself too, many times, at that odd RAF Special Duties airfield, you see. Even spent a night in the Moon Squadron's private ivy-covered cottage hidden in a small wood at the edge of the normal airfield. There hadn't been any other place to put her, and she'd been very carefully segregated from the other visitors. She had some idea of the difficulties that peculiar squadron had in finding and keeping pilots. Hundreds of hours night flying required, and fluent French, and though they could only take volunteers, they were such a secret operation that they weren't allowed to actively recruit anyone. Maddie has a rule about passing on favors which she calls the aerodrome drop-off principle. It is very simple. If someone needs to get to an airfield and you can get them there by taxi Anson or motorbike or pony trap or piggyback, you should always take them. Because someday, you will need a ride to an airfield too. Someone different will have to take you, so the favor gets passed on instead of paid back. Now, talking to Jamie, Maddie thought of all the little things Dimpna Withenshaw had done or said on Maddie's behalf. Things which had cost Dimpna nothing, but which had changed Maddie's life. Maddie knew she could never repay Dimpna, but now, according to the aerodrome drop-off principle, Maddie had a chance to pass the life-changing favors on.
You should ask your CO about special duties flying, Maddie said to Jamie. I think you'd have a good chance of getting in with them.
Special duties, Jamie echoed, just as Maddie had echoed Theo Lyons a few months back.
They fly dead hush-hush missions, Maddie said. Short field operations, night landings, Lysander's and sometimes Hudson's. It's not a big squadron. Volunteer for RAF special duties, and if you need a reference, ask to talk to...
The name she gave Jamie was the alias of the intelligence officer who recruited me. It was probably the most daring thing she'd ever done. Maddie could only guess at what he was. But she'd remembered his name, or rather, the name he'd used when he bought her a whiskey in the Green Man. And she'd seen him more than once on the secret airfield. And he thought he was so clever, too. Plenty of odd civilians came and went from that airfield, but Maddie didn't see many of them. And when she recognized the one she did see, it stuck in her head as a most peculiar coincidence. Bloody Machiavellian English intelligence officer playing God. Jamie repeated the name aloud to fix it in his head, and leaned forward to peer at Maddie more closely in the firelight from the library grate. Where the devil have you come by that sort of information?
Careless talk costs lives, Maddie answered sternly, and the pobble who has no toes laughed because it sounded so like his little sister. I mean his younger sister. I mean me. How I would love to stay in the library at Craig Castle with them all night. Later, Maddie slept in my bed. Mother always keeps our beds made up, just in case. It was cold, with the window open, but, like Mother and Mrs. Darling, Maddie left the window as she found it, also just in case. I wish I could indulge in writing about my bedroom, but I must stop early today so von Linden can prep me for this radio interview tomorrow. Anyway, my bedroom at home in Craig Castle, Castle Craig, has nothing to do with the war. This bloody radio interview. Oh, lies, lies, and damned lies.
Orme, 2011-43, JBS.
I'm supposed to use this time to make my own notes on the radio interview yesterday, as a kind of backstop in case the actual broadcast doesn't match up with what VL remembers of it. I would have written about it anyway. Buckets of blood, when do I get to finish my great dissertation of treason? They really made an effort to make me presentable, as though I were a debutante to be presented to the King of England all over again. It was decided, not by me, that my beloved pullover makes me look too thin and pale, and is also getting a wee bit ragged, so they washed and pressed my blouse and temporarily gave me back my grey silk scarf. I was flabbergasted to find they still had it. I suppose it must be part of my file, and they are still hunting for unrevealed code in the Paisley. They let me put my hair up, but made a lot of fuss over how to fix it, because no one trusts me with hairpins. In the end, I was allowed to use pencil stubs. My God, they are petty. I was also allowed to do it myself because A, Engel could not make it stay, B, she could not hide the pencils as well as I did. And even after soaking my fingertips in kerosene for an hour, who suspected kerosene has so many uses? They have failed to get rid of the ink stains beneath my fingernails. But that just adds credibility to the stenographer story, I think. Also, because afterwards my hands positively reeked of kerosene, I was then allowed to scrub myself all over with a lovely, creamy little bar of Curious American soap, which floated in the basin when you let go of it. Where in the world did that come from? Apart from the obvious America. It looked like hotel soap, but the wrapper was in English, and it couldn't have been from this hotel. CDM. Le Château des Mystères. Engel did my nails. I was not let to do them myself, lest I stab someone with the file. She was as vicious as possible without actually drawing blood. She succeeded in making me cry. But otherwise, it is a perfect manicure. I feel sure she has fashion sense lurking beneath the Teutonic Mädchen guise she affects for the Gestapo. They installed me at the marquetry table with some harmless dummy documents to work on, finding the best connections between French rail and bus timetables and making a list of them in German. When they brought in the interviewer, I stood up with an artificial smile and crossed the antique Persian carpet to welcome her, feeling exactly as though I were playing the secretary on the opening night set of Agatha Christie's play Alibi. "Georgia Penn," the radio announcer introduced herself, offering me her hand. She is about a foot taller than me and walks with a stick and a prodigious limp. As old as von Linden, big and loud and friendly, well, just American. She worked in Spain during the Civil War as a foreign correspondent and got very badly treated by the Republicans, hence her pro-fascist bent. She is normally based in Paris and does a radio show called No Place Like Home, full of jive tunes and pie recipes and discouraging hints that if you are stationed on a battleship in the Mediterranean, your girl is probably cheating on you back in the States. This rubbish is broadcast over and over to make the American soldiers homesick. Apparently, Yanks will listen to anything if it includes decent music. The BBC is too serious for them. I shook this treacherous woman's hand and said coolly, en français pour que l'Obsturmführer who doesn't speak English puisse nous comprendre, "I'm afraid I can't tell you my name." She glanced over at von Linden, who stood deferentially at her shoulder. "Pourquoi?" she demanded of him. She is even taller than von Linden, and her French has got all the same broad, twangy American vowels as her English. Why can't I know her name? She looked back down at me from her colossal height. I adjusted my scarf and assumed the casual pose of a saint stuck full of arrows, hands linked loosely behind my back, one foot turned out before the other with the knee slightly bent, my head cocked to one side. "It's for my own protection," I said. "I don't want my name publicized." What tosh. I suppose I could have said, "I'm supposed to vanish into the night and fog." Don't know what she would have made of that. I wasn't even allowed to tell her what branch of the military I'm serving with. Von Linden gave me a chair as well, next to Miss Penn, away from the table where I'd been working. Engel hovered subordinately. Miss Penn offered a cigarette to von Linden, who waved it away in disdain. "May I?" she said, and when he shrugged politely, she took one herself and offered another to me. Bet Engel wanted one. I said, "Merci mille fois." He said nothing. Oh, mein Hauptsturmführer. You coward. She set about lighting the cigarettes and announced in her brisk, straightforward French, "I don't want to waste my time listening to propaganda. It's my job, and I'm wise to it. I'll be frank with you. I'm looking for truth. Je cherche la vérité." "Your accent is frightful," I answered, also in French. Would you repeat that in English? She did, taking no insult, very serious through a pall of smoke. I'm looking for Verity. It's a bloody good thing he let me have that cigarette, because otherwise I don't know how I'd have managed to conceal that every one of us was dealing out her own damned pack of lies. Truth, I said at last, in English. Truth, she agreed. Engel came running to my aid with a saucer, there being no ashtrays. I'd sucked the whole cigarette down to the butt in 5 or 6 long drags, composing myself to answer. Verity, I said in English, and exhaled every last molecule of nicotine and oxygen I had inside me. Then gasped. Truth is the daughter of time, not authority. And, this above all, to thine own self be true. I gibbered a bit, I confess. Verity, I am the soul of Verity. I laughed so wildly then that the Hauptsturmfuhrer had to clear his throat to remind me to control myself. I am the soul of Verity, I repeated. Je suis l'esprit de vérité. In amongst the tobacco fog, Georgia Penn very kindly handed me what was left of her own cigarette. Well, thank goodness for that, she said in motherly tones, so I can trust you to give me honest answers. She glanced up at von Linden. You know what they call this place? I raised my eyebrows, shrugging. Le Chateau de Bordeaux, she said. I laughed rather too loudly again, crossed my legs and examined the inside of my wrist. It is a pun, you see. Chateau de Bordeaux, Chateau de Bordeaux. Bordeaux Castle, Castle of Butchers. No. I'd not heard that, I said. And honestly, I haven't, perhaps because I'm so isolated most of the time. Shows you how distracted I am that I didn't think of it myself. Well, as you can see, I am still in one piece. She really looked at me hard for a second, just one second. I smoothed my skirt down over my knee. Then she became businesslike and produced a notebook and pen, while a pale Gestapo underling who looked about 12 years old poured cognac. Cognac! For the three of us. The three of us! VL, GP, and me! Not Engel! Out of a crystal decanter into snifters as big as my head. At this point, I became so deeply suspicious of everyone in the room that I could not remember what I was supposed to say. Alibi. Alibi is all I could think of. This is different. I don't know what's going on. He wants to catch me off guard. It's a new trick. Is the room bugged? Why have they lit the fire and not the chandelier? And what does the talking cockatoo have to do with it? Wait. What else is there to get out of me? I'm giving the Gestapo everything I know. I've been doing it for weeks. Pull yourself together, lassie. You're a Wallace and a Stuart. At this point, I purposefully put out my cigarette against my own palm. Nobody noticed. To hell with the truth, I told myself fiercely. I want another week. I want my week, and I'm going to get it. I asked if we could speak in English for the interview. It felt more natural to talk to the American in English, and with Engel there to translate, the Hauptsturmfuhrer did not mind. So then it was up to me, really, to put on a good show. He did not want me to tell her about the codes I'd given him. Certainly not about the, stressful circumstances under which I'd collapsed and coughed them up. Nor that the 11 wireless sets in Maddie's Lysander were all destroyed in the fire when she crashed. He showed me those pictures during my interrogation. The enlargements from the pilot's cockpit came later. I think I mentioned them here, but I'm not going to describe them. I don't entirely follow the logic of what I could or couldn't tell the American broadcaster, since if she cared to, she could have easily found out from anyone in Orme about those destroyed radio sets. But perhaps no one has told British intelligence yet, and the Gestapo is still playing the radio game, das Funkspiel, trying to play back my compromised codes and frequencies on one of their previously captured wireless sets. I suppose I should have written about those pictures, only I couldn't. Literally couldn't. It was during those days when I'd run out of paper. but I won't now, either. I said I was a wireless operator, parachuted here in civilian clothes so I might not attract attention, and that I had been caught because I made a cultural blunder. We chatted a bit about the difficulty of being a foreigner and trying to assimilate yourself into French daily life. Engel nodded sagely in agreement, not while she was listening to me, but as she was repeating it to von Linden. Oh, how strange this war is. Mirabile dictu. The wee Scots wireless set, I mean operator, is still nursing small, hidden, nasty short circuits got during her savagely inhuman interrogation. Yet she can keep a straight face as she sits beneath the Venetian chandelier, with the American Pen and the Germans Engel and von Linden sharing cognac and complaining about the French. It made the right impression, though, finding something we all agreed on. Penn then remarked that Engel's English must have been picked up in the American Midwest, which left the rest of us speechless for a longish moment. Then Engel confessed that she had been a student at the University of Chicago for a year, where she was training as a chemist. I don't think I've ever met anyone with so much wasted talent. Penn tried to make her play the do-you-know game, but the only person they had in common was Henry Ford, whom Engel had met at a charity dinner. Engel's American contacts were all very respectably pro-Germany, Penn's less so. They were not in Chicago at the same time. Penn has been based in Europe since early in the 30s. Fräulein Anna Engel, MDM, Mädchen de Mystère. We looked at my translated bus schedule and admired VL's Mont Blanc fountain pen, which I'd been using. Penn asked me if I was worried about my upcoming trial. It's a formality. I could not help being brutal about this. I will be shot. She asked for honesty, after all. I am a military emissary, caught in enemy territory masquerading as a civilian. I count as a spy. The Geneva Convention doesn't protect me. She was silent for a moment. There's a war on, I added, to remind her. Yes. She scribbled some notes on her pad. Well, you're very brave. All tosh. Can you speak on behalf of other prisoners here? We don't see much of each other. Had to dodge that one. Or not to speak to. I do see them too often. Will you get a tour? She nodded. It looks very nice. Clean linen in all the rooms. A bit Spartan. Well heated, too, I said waspishly. It used to be a hotel. No proper dungeon rooms, no damp, no one suffering arthritis at all. They must have taken around the rooms they used for the orderlies. Perhaps even planted a few as dummy prisoners. The Gestapo used the ground floor and two mezzanines for their own accommodation and offices. And it is all kept in beautiful condition. The real prisoners are kept on the uppermost three stories. It is harder to escape when you're at least 40 feet from the ground. Penn seemed satisfied. She heaved a tight smile in von Linden's direction and said, Ich danke Ihnen. I thank you. Very grave and formal. Then continued in French to tell him how grateful she was for this unique and unusual opportunity. I suppose she'll interview him too, separate from me. Then she leaned in close to me and said in confidential tones, Can I get you anything? Send you anything? Little things? Towels? I told her I'd stopped. Well, I have, and they wouldn't let her anyway. Would they? I don't know. According to the Geneva Convention, you're allowed to send useful things to prisoners of war. Cigarettes, toothbrushes, fruitcakes with hacksaws in. But as I'd just pointed out, the Geneva Convention doesn't apply to me. Nacht und Nebel. Night and fog. As far as Georgia Penn knows, I have no name. Who would she address the package to? She asked, You're not... It was a rather extraordinary conversation if you think about it, both of us speaking in code, but not military code, not intelligence or resistance code, just feminine code. You haven't been... I'm sure Engel was able to fill in the blanks. Can I send you sanitary towels? No thanks, I've stopped, bleeding. You're not pregnant. You haven't been raped. Raped. What was she going to do about it if I had? Anyway, technically speaking, I've not been raped. No, I've just stopped. I've not had a cycle since I left England. I think my body simply shut itself down during those